Good morning, as promised, Assignment 4 Solutions. So, where are we? There's my mouse. So, wing coat. What? Why is it doing that? That's really weird. So, when code runs in a sandbox environment, does this refer to a specific security technology? No. Sandbox does not refer to a specific security technology. Instead, it refers to the goal of isolating code so it runs within a restricted environment. That's basically what I was looking for. I then explained a bit, but, you know, while code is sandboxed by running with it, anyway. The idea is that there's different technologies. You can use the, you know, a language runtime, you can use OS level isolation mechanisms, you can even in principle use do stack analysis. Those have all been used to sandbox things. Questions? Raise your hand if you have questions. Oh, by the way, who's taking notes? I don't know if it makes sense to take notes during this part, but are people done with taking notes? Okay. Why is it hard to implement protection boundaries within a process as compared to having an operating system implement protection boundaries? Explain briefly. I was looking for something simple there. Because the operating system has access to hardware mechanisms for enforcing boundaries, and the process doesn't. It's got things like virtual memory and supervisor kernel, you know, supervisor user mode. The OS has all those mechanisms. Running in user mode as a process, you don't have any of that. So you gotta use other tricks, which basically is like, I mean, there's a reason those hardware mechanisms were implemented in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Isn't like TCP wrapped in
That's more of a virtualization type thing, because basically, you know, you're adding in a level of interposition between it. And it's not, normally you think of isolating things within a process, and TCP wrappers isolating the process from the outside. So I wouldn't quite call that, but again, I was looking, look at that. Nice little close tag. Browsers are pretty forgiving of losing closed tags. Okay. So system calls versus functions. System calls. Because if an attacker gets control of a process, they can bypass any protections that are implemented at a function call level. If they're implemented in the system call boundary, the kernel's enforcing it. And the only way for them to bypass those checks is to take over the kernel, which is a whole other level of things. I mean, of course, if your kernel's compromised, then, well, everything's gone. So basically, you can put security restrictions in a function, but it's very hard to make sure that they won't be bypassed. I mean, now, you could say, you know, instead, a thing in between functions and system calls is if you do it in the language runtime. Because the language runtime isn't directly accessible by the language that's running. You know, JavaScript can't change the JavaScript runtime. So that's a place. But that's not what I was really asking here. I mean, if you start drawing those distinctions, then you can that's fine. Okay, so then getting to the question 4, how do language runtimes provide opportunities for enforcing security properties? Because they... I actually didn't say that. Really, I'll say because language runtimes virtualize the system. That's really what I should say there. But it's because they maintain control of the execution environment, either whether they're interpreter or just in time, they're always there. So they can, as part of translating the code and executing it, they can also restrict the code because they're deciding what code gets executed. Now, you can't do that so much with compiled language because normally compiled language, well, even if a compiled language says, oh, I will put the checking into the binary, well, that checking is now at the same level as all the other code in the binary. So it's principle possible for that to be bypassed. So it's like, you can try to do it, but normally if you have a just-in-time compilation thing, then the runtime can maintain control dynamically at any point. I'm not saying you could try doing these things with compiled languages, but then you end up turning it into a JIT-like system because you just have the runtime constantly taking control rather than having the compiled code just run on its own. I do not know why the mouse keeps ending up in the corner.
The touch screen in the bottom is probably worn out.
Yeah. And I'm not even near touching.
The just like pressing.
Oh, right, the leaning on the table. Right, jiggling the table. I forgot about that. Okay, five. So five is the Pinterest save button. Did you all like looking at that? Was that kind of funny? So the thing about this is, what is extent? This was really, the first 2 points were really gimmies. Look at the page and copy down what's there. It's like, what does this extension do? Save things to Pinterest. save things to Pinterest. What permissions it require? List the permissions that were listed on the site. Why does it need these permissions? I know why it needs, access to the websites, because they have to be able to figure out what URL you're on. It has to find the URL and then has to, potentially grab images from within the page. So it kind of makes sense it has access to that. The other permissions? I have no idea. Why does it need access to your theme? And to what you've downloaded?
I figured that out.
Oh, you did? Okay, that's what...
The theming is because it can modify in the downloaded manager, it can change the way that looks. So it just gets...
But why? Okay.
The monitor usage is so it can check for conflicts with other add-ons that could occur. Mm-hmm. But the reason the author probably included that one is because it gives them a real-time update of how many times the add-in is installed, like how many people are actually using it and it's activated. So if you're doing it for ego, which this person probably is because they're not making money, that might motivate you, right?
Okay. Yeah?
Doesn't the access all data include
safe
passwords?
It does, yeah.
And you need that to actually have like access to your Pinterest or the extension, which is why it needs that.
But the Facebook, Firefox permissions includes access data for X website? I'm pretty sure
it's... Laziness?
Yeah, that's what I was saying. So is it possible? What is it possible to do? It's like, this is going like, what can you not do? I can modify any page you visit. I can, I can change what you've downloaded. I can do things. I can, mess with your theme. I mess with your theme. You can mess with your interface.
So is that could you attribute sort of that to the fact that some of the permissions are pretty broad in their descriptions and what they allow for?
This is the thing that I did not directly ask you about, but this is the thing clearly you should be thinking about, is why is this situation like this? Least privilege. This is so not least privilege. This is like, oh my God, you can just do it. And people say, oh, we have permissions in the browser, so extensions are safe. Really? This is safe? It's one thing to say you have to trust the writer of the extension, but the whole idea of permission is like, well, I only have to trust them so much. It's like, okay, I made sure you didn't bring a gun in, but I let you had a knife and a nuclear bomb. So I'm really well protected. it just doesn't make much sense. Now you can say, well, how would you change could you change the permission model of the browser so it would allow for better least privilege? Could you do so in a way that developers would understand and ask for just the right permissions rather than asking for too many, especially since they have goals that may be not quite what the browser developer meant, like keeping track of how many times their extension was installed and stuff. People get creative. I don't know, but it's just, you should go like, whoa. It should make you, the reason I put this in there was, first of all, to make you stop and think about extensions to browsers.
So I think this is basically like the exact same problem that comes up with POSIX capabilities.
It is exactly the same problem with POSIX capabilities. So if you go down the rabbit hole of saying, I really don't want permissions to be... too coarse. I want to make sure I give an application just the permissions it needs and no more. So that way I'm secure. That path, and I want to make sure those permissions don't get messed with, that takes you down the path of really fine-grained permission models and mandatory access control. And you end up with systems such as SE Linux, which is on the other side, where nobody knows how to write policies. And in fact, the most... This I can say seriously. I have a PhD student right now who is trying to figure out SE Linux policies. It's taken her quite a while to figure things out. And she keeps learning more and then realizes, oh my God, there's this. And you go like, what? And what? And you know, it's like, okay, so what's the most common thing people ask about SE Linux? How do you turn it off? So I don't have a real good solution except to say the entire model of access control is a bit broken. I'm not saying you shouldn't have access control, but there's something just fundamentally broken about an approach where you have, or a little lineup where either you end up with permissions that people understand that give way too much away, or permissions that nobody understands, and so they can't be used. It's just, this is really what brought me to like thinking about anomaly detection. Going like, you can't have people making these decisions. We've got to let the system learn what the boundary is between acceptable and unacceptable. It leads to other problems, but those at least seem more tractable to me than trying to figure out access control and the usability problem. I do not want to close tabs. So six. I forgot to answer that last time. So how's iOS's runtime security, like OS virtualization implemented Linux vSphere or a similar system? How is it different? So what'd you all get for that? I can explain my answer, but
I put that it's the biggest difference between them is the relationship between applications. And then iOS, they're like on their own little island, whereas in the other one, the Linux was at an OS level. So within an OS container, you could have applications talking with each other. They just couldn't go outside. That, for me, that was the biggest difference.
Well, I mean, so if you look at what... But they're both doing OS virtualization. It's possible for an iOS application to have more than one process, as I understand. Well, actually, I don't know. Is it? I know it can certainly be multi-threaded.
Yeah, you can multi-thread, but you have to ask the system for that permission.
Okay. Can you ask for another process in your application?
I don't think so.
Okay. Because, as I understand it, iOS, I mean, really, it's like OS-level virtualization. It's really sandboxing because it has its own view of the file system. It can't see other processes. It's got, you know, it's really, you know, limited in what it can do. But, and so it's kind of like OS virtualization. I'd say the differences I saw are things like code signing. iOS has all this thing of code signing and deciding what access you have using that. OS level virtualization traditionally doesn't have anything with code signing. And there's all these kind of ways you can ask for permission to do certain things and stuff to get more access, which isn't there in digital OS level virtualization. It's like you're in this box and that's all you get.
Mm-hmm. I said that you could actually talk between apps with API, so it kind of knows it's in a sandbox because of that, rather than OS virtualization where you don't have to communicate like that at all.
Right. Okay. Yes, yeah, right. If you're running OS virtualization, it's like you don't know that you can't see the other folks.
Yeah.
It seems like you own the whole machine. But you're right, with you have API, so you know that, oh yeah, there is a Twitter app on here that I can invoke. If you want it to or not. Okay, so and again, the purpose of that question was really for you to sit there and look through that great Apple security white paper.
Pages 23 and 24. Thank you for that.
Yeah, I was being a little kind with this one. I figured some of y'all would have to optimize for time, so I tried to make it doable, but I mean, look through this thing. It's just crazy, the stuff they have. I mean, this is a 78-page document, and it's all about the ways in they do stuff. And if you look at this and compare it to what Android does, it's like, no. I mean, a lot of these mechanisms, it's like Android has support for them, and then almost nobody uses them. And then other ones, it's like, okay, they use them. It's like just things like encrypting this flash memory. It's like there's all this elaborate stuff encrypted. The flash memory is encrypted so that if you were to, you know, disable power and someone tries to get it, they cannot physically get at the data because the secrets needed to unlock that are stored in the secure enclave, and you can't get past that unless you enter the pins, and it rate limits you how many pins you can try and stuff. So it's, you know, they've locked this down. There's nothing like, I mean, Android supports encrypted partitions and stuff, and then they don't seem to be used. I don't know. Has that changed for any of the modern flagships? I know that was true a couple of years ago. Do any of them come encrypted out of the box? Except maybe the Pixels? I think the Pixels do.
Yeah, they do.
But even the Pixels, I'm not sure how locked down that secure enclave things are, because they're using, as far as I know, the ARM off-the-shelf trust zone stuff. Right. And Apple has spent time engineering their entire trust chain. So, I mean, it's not something, there's pieces, parts that let you do things, but Apple's the only one I know is like really said, okay, we're going to really think about this. And it's kind of depressing. You know, because you'd think it's built on Linux. Shouldn't it be able to be much better? Well, iOS is Unix, so to first approximation. And then the definitions here. So I gave a, this is a simple answer to your definitions. I mean, a white list is a list of acceptable inputs. A blacklist, a list of unacceptable inputs. And that's really, anomaly detection, it's like you detect something weird. Anomaly, detect anomalies on the basis that those anomalies are correlated with security violations. And virtualization is you intermediate access to a resource through an abstraction. That's, you know, those kind of definitions. Now, in terms of examples, lots of examples. I just gave some here. You know, a password's a whitelist. Are you allowed in or not? You know, anti-malware scanners, blacklists of bad binaries. Anomaly detection. Those aren't actually used on most of our systems, but in finance, they're used all the time. You know, I hope most of you have credit cards at this point. I know some of you may avoid them, but you kind of need to have one at some point. But if you do, and you start traveling, and you start doing things, they do things like send you a text message, or phone your home, or maybe send a message in an app, and like, no. Or if they're not so nice, they just turn off access to your card when they suspect suspicious activity. Yes?
RBC is hypersensitive.
RBC's hypersensitive?
Yeah, if I do anything, I control it's their problem.
It's really company specific, bank specific of what their policies are.
They do it on debit transactions now too.
Thank God. Debit transaction. Although there's one thing with you should always understand with credit cards is if you enter a PIN, you're on the hook. It's kind of the burden of proof tends to, it's, you know, there's been lots of examples of this in Europe because they've been using chip and PIN much longer, is that if you enter in a PIN, the assumption is you did it. And thus, you have to basically then, you're basically, the burden of proof is on you to say this is fraudulent. Unless you can kind of go and like, no, there's all these ways for people to steal PINs and all these ways to break it. But that's at least the way the European, well, that's the way the European laws are. I don't know actually what the Canadian laws are. So a tap is a completely different thing because you haven't verified that you are there. So tap has much better fraud characteristics. And this is also the reason why I don't like to use debit cards for purchases. Because in the case of a credit card fraud, you contest it and you just, it's on your thing. You haven't paid them yet. And so it's in dispute and you're, you know, doing that. With debit, the money's gone from your account. And sometimes they give you a credit, sometimes they don't, but it's gone.
If you threaten to go public with the vulnerabilities in TAP, they'll pay you hush money. That's why you want to keep a low limit, because the lower it is, the more likely, like the less you have to threaten, but they'll take the cost.
Yeah, for TAP, but I'm thinking that it's like with debit, and you do, with debit and tap, okay, you know, mid-limit, but with debit and chip and PIN, I mean, now it's on you. It's like, wait, you told someone your PIN? How do we know it's not authorized? Are you sure you didn't give it to someone? You know, it's like, it's on you. And with credit cards, at least you can kind of go, you can have this whole dispute resolution. They might threaten you with interest or whatever, but you still have your money. And with debit, you don't. So that's one, and also there's another thing, is that it's not like you pay a lower price. Credit cards, they're taking 1-2% of every transaction, separate from any interest they charge you. You know, during the merchant, they take 1%. That, if you pay cash, you don't see that. You know, you pay with debit, you don't see that, but even though the fees are lower. So if you use a credit card and you have rewards, you can, you know, maybe get some of that money back. It's a cost of our system. I don't necessarily like it, but you should know what it is. Anyway, that was a longer thing. But anyway, credit cards and then virtualization. is when access to a resource is intermediate abstraction, virtual memory, classic example. But lots of examples of all of these, as long as it basically, you know, you point out how it fits with these things, you're fine. Questions? Do you want to talk about assignment three or the things? I'm guessing a lot of you are kind of like have not digested a lot of this. So one thing I normally do is have a review session later on. Would you all be interested in a review session before the final exam? I can put a poll up on Slack to kind of figure out what the time is, and I'll record the audio for it. I'm thinking, so it's on the 20th, right?
It's a Friday.
Which is a Friday. So I'm kind of thinking like the 17th or something. What? Your exam. I figured, yeah, 17th or 18th. Maybe the 18th. I don't know. I'll do a poll. What? I'll do a poll and just kind of give some time slots. And we'll see what people, and I'll say, check off all the ones you can attend. Then otherwise, I can certainly talk about things. One thing, did you all see what I posted for there was something I posted to Slack. What was it? I posted a couple of things, but there was, just trying to remember, there was something that I just thought was hilarious. Address book contact security. Did you all see that? Another bit of stupidity about permissions. So this was a case that, you know, if you install an app on your phone, at least in iOS, you know, a lot of times it'll ask for things like access to your contacts. And then it'll ask, so it's access to your contacts, and I feel like there was one other permission it wanted that was really common. But so if you have access to the contacts, it means not just read access, it's also write access. And so they can do things like add a phone number to someone's contact. And then it looks like, you think it's coming from mom, it's not. It's a message from somewhere else. Oh, and also they get access to like your email because you do a confirmation. And so basically what you can do is get you to trust an email that you don't expect or trust a number you don't expect. And yeah, it's a good phishing technique, but it's just sort of this, read through it, it's kind of funny how these permissions
just to confirm,
go through.
You need to install the app and give it permission to your contacts for that too?
Yes. Normally on iOS you don't have access to the address book, but a lot of apps do. But there's no notion of write versus read access. Because normally, if you have access to the address book, they say you want to add a contact. And why random apps should be adding things to your contacts is just like, why can't that be delegated to something else? Anyway, I can certainly talk about more stuff, but I kind of feel like you're at the part of the semester where you kind of want to run away and deal with stuff. So. My plan is I'm going to stick around here to answer questions. I know some of you have some grading issues that you want to do, so if I can stick around here and deal with things.
I have one group question.
Yes.
When we first came to class the first day, you said experiences were worth 10%, and then the next day you said that they were worth 20%, and I was just wondering if the first day rules are still in effect.
I do consider alternative grading schemes.
Mm-hmm.
So I do juggle things around. I'm sticking with what I put in the course outline,
okay,
because I think there were some discrepancies in it not adding up to 100%.
Okay.
But I understand some of you want to optimize for not doing the experiences.
Not me. I'm
okay.
I'm asking for a
yes.
Friend.
Okay. I would say it is worth your time spending doing this, and even as preparing for the final exam, because you need some hands-on experience to get a lot of these things, and you should be like going, I don't understand this, so you should try playing with something or looking at a respray to get a bit more depth. So I do think it's important. I know a lot of you have not done that, but try to spend some time, and if you need an extension, you know, to do some of it, let me know, but d- do what you can. Don't kill yourself. You have to do a balance of other things. I mean, you can say, you know, if you do half of them, you know, you get, you know, you'll get, you know, at least 50% of it or so, roughly, maybe 30, 40. But I mean, grade optimization is the thing I know you have to do. Do what you can. But if you're putting in an honest effort and like have put in time and like been trying to participate, like you're gonna get a good grade. If you've been slacking off on lots of things, aspects of the class, grade's not gonna be as good. I mean, but if you've learned it all, I tend to give more weight to the final exam and stuff if you really show that you've mastered the material by the means. So, I don't want you to feel like, you know, you kind of, but you know, just do what you can. And if you can help out your fellow students on this on SLAF, you still can. And that does count for something. So, thank you very much. I'll stick around here to answer questions, and I will probably see you at the. Okay.
The final exam is the same as the.
Yes.
As longer.
Except longer. It's the assignment. Just like the midterm, you knew what the midterm was from assignment 1 and 2. The final exam, you'll know from all 4 assignments.
Thank you.